improvised music and particularly computer music as well, and cognition, because I believe that it's only those things which are cognized amongst the structural components which are of significance for how we are effectively responding and how we are, I believe, pro-socially affected. So I want to talk about a little bit of the aspects of jazz improvisation in particular and computer interactive improvisation in particular, which has been poorly addressed from that point of view. I'm sure you'll be familiar with the fact that we know quite a bit about the recurrent harmonic and rhythmic patterns which are commonly used in mainstream jazz and conventional jazz and the importance of swing. There's been quite a bit of work about what things are superimposed in those contexts, but in the context of freer improvisation, there's a widespread view that microstructural components create macrostructure. In a sense, conventional jazz has a top-down dominance and free jazz has an up, towards the top dominance. But very few aspects of that idea of structure in jazz have really been investigated carefully, and almost none from a cognitive point of view. So I'm interested in long-term interactions which can also be superimposed, which are important in computer interactive improvisation, on which I've written a book. And today I want to talk about dynamics, meaning primarily intensity of sound. There's quite a lot of evidence that when we listen to things, we do perceive transitions in music, so that there's a segmental structure as far as we are concerned. And this leads to the idea which has been particularly promoted by theorists and cognitive people like David Huron, that we actually anticipate things later in music. And I'm not just talking about anticipating events in music with which one's familiar, so-called veridical anticipation, but I'm talking about anticipation even in music which one is completely unfamiliar with. You gradually build up some concept of the patterns which lead you to expectations. And because sonic cognition is biologically important, it's those kind of expectations which help us to use sound for survival, I'm interested in how they might work within music, such as the focus of today's conference. And in particular, I want to tell you about some studies on the ramp archetype, which is an aspect of control of dynamic intensity, which may well be important in how we attend to music. This is a theory put forward by David Huron, to whom I just referred, suggesting that if you want to construct a piece of music in such a way that it maximally engages the attention of listeners, you will do so by having a series of ramps which take quite a long time to crescendo and relatively short times to diminuendo. And the basis for that argument is biological. It's about looming of objects which one needs to worry about and their disappearance which one does not need to worry about. And conversely, one might expect that ambient music, such as that of Brian Eno, would not use this structure. There's a lot of evidence from Huron's early work in the 90s about notation of such crescendi and decrescendi, suggesting that the ramp archetype might exist, but there's none at all which is concerned with audible ramp archetypes. And obviously in the case of improvised music, we can't work from notation anyway, or at least it would be almost impossible. So we need to work from the acoustic information, which is what I would be most interested in as a an improviser and researcher myself anyway. So that's what I'm going to tell you about. So the hypothesis is that in several kinds of jazz, and probably very widely in improvised music, structure of dynamic intensity will be based on very long crescendi and very short decrescendi. There are one or two corollaries that this would predict, that of course the rate of increase in dynamic in a crescendo would be lower than the rate of decrease in a decrescendo. And there are one or two people who've not thought about it in these ways, but pointed to precedents in the literature. I mentioned Lewis Porter's discussion of Coltrane's Love Supreme. There's a major article in the Journal of American Musicology where he talks about waves, thinking about pitch in particular. And one could have ramps, of course, in pitch or in any other component of music. I'm just focusing on dynamics today. Then in a very recent book, Hodson, thinking about interaction in the way that Monson and Jeff Pressing and myself and John Sloboda have talked previously, also thinks about ramps and has a little diagram which is exactly like a ramp archetype, but he is referring to musical intensity, which of course is an undefined and very complex concept. So I'm suggesting that there are quite a lot of examples of jazz where the ramp archetype is very overt, and if you think about Mingus's music with accelerandi and decelerandi, those are probably very important examples yet to be studied. What I want to show you is a study of four particular pieces of jazz which are quite varied. I won't go into detail about the methods which are used here, but this is computational assessment of the acoustic properties of sound physical properties on the one hand, and an estimation of loudness as perceived via the cochlea on the other. So I'll be talking about intensity, which is the physical property, and loudness, which is the perceived property. And I'm going to measure in a variety of pieces patterns of these crescendi and decrescendi using a software platform called Pratt. excuse me. The examples are from Miles Davis, My Funny Valentine. You'll be very familiar with that. I won't let you hear that now. But also from the very important computer interactive ensemble, probably the first one, The Hub, from San Francisco in the late 80s and 90s. And if we can get sound, let me just give you a feel for that piece. It is very rhythmic, but in a quite unusual way. Consists of successive segments, as you can hear, with gaps between them, which are constructed in quite a complex way computationally. I won't go into it beyond that. Another example, which is also rhythmic, which I've analysed, is from my own group, which is very motoric, that has a lot of layers of rhythmic complexity. Is from Kurt Elling. And you're probably familiar with that, I hope. Now, I'm just going to show you the sort of data that I get from this and give you the key points within it. This is all the data, or a large selection of the data, relating to My Funny Valentine. And My Funny Valentine was analysed not only in relation to fixed time windows, but also, as you see down the bottom, in relation to what are called text grids. That's picking four-bar phrases within the piece and analysing them as they are, as independent phrases. And the crucial observation is in the left-hand column, that all those numbers which represent the duration of the crescendo divided by the duration of the decrescendo in each pair of crescendi and decrescendi, they're all much greater than one. And in four cases there, they're dramatically, statistically, significantly greater than one. So there's a general observation here which is consistent with my proposal that that particular piece is constructed largely in ramp archetypes of dynamics. There is a corollary which you can see in the right-hand column that on average the rate of crescendo is rather lesser than the rate of diminuendo in the column preceding it. This is the same kind of observation for the Hub piece, and again if you look at the left hand column all the numbers are far greater than one. There are many significant ones, and there's a roughly comparable observation about the relationship between crescendo and diminuendo rates. And you'll see that we have two different units, by the way, for intensity: decibels for the physical property and sones for the perceptual one. Now this is the case of the third piece, the engine piece from Australitis, where the same observation is largely true, and there are two statistically significant incidences of it, and there's only one counterexample, the fourth number up on the left-hand side in red, where the ratio is slightly less. And there's a kind of counteraction here in that there's also a very high rate of crescendo, but this is a piece which only has two ramps in it, as measured this way, in a 10-second window. So it's not very surprising that sometimes you would see that. The key observation is the statistical one, that the ramp time ratio is nearly always greater than one, and is always so in those cases that are statistically significant. In the view of time, I'm just going to go quite quickly about Kurt Elling and say that in another piece of work, Hazel Smith and my partner and I have been studying the way that he merges singing and speaking into what we call song talk. And during that study, which has been presented at a conference recently, we also looked at the ramp archetype in his work, observed it particularly in that piece I played you a sample of, Resolution. There the ramps had this numerical ratio between 1.3 and 1.9. But what I thought I would show you also is that he, and I'm sure many other musicians, also think about the dynamic curvature, the ramp as I'm calling it, in relation to how they construct a whole performance. In Kurt Elling's case, we have some good evidence on this because we have some performances from a live session in Chicago, and we also have one album on which he constructed the album as two sets, in the way that US sets, as you know, are contained entities, and you have a different audience for the first set from the second, rather different from the system in Britain or Australia. So he's constructed these sets on the record as if they were performance sets, and by looking at the mean intensity of each of the pieces and assigning them towards the crescendo or decrescendo phase, you come to exactly the same conclusion, that a ramp archetype in the overall performance structure of the whole set is in place. And I think that's very interesting from the point of view of long-term attention, just as the ramps within the short-term piece are important for short-term attention. And I have yet to establish, and there may well be somebody here who knows, whether the material on My Funny Valentine and Four and More is in the right order and is complete, because if so, of course, we can make the same analysis on that, and I have not yet done that. So looking at interpretations, when David Huron proposed this idea, he talked primarily about dynamics per se and about listeners. But I think that it's actually much more useful and much more pertinent to think of it in terms of the force or the effort, if you like, the intensity from the point of view of the performer. And it is, of course, the case that to make a louder noise on most instruments, you have to apply more physical force and more mental effort. And so, because there are comparable processes both with acoustic instruments and with computer music, I think we should integrate this idea into the view that force and effort as transmitted through the piece is something which becomes energy and loudness for the listener, and that feel, as I'm calling it here, is what is important in the overall impact of one upon the other. So I see the ramp archetype as one of musical and physical effort, and as a seeking for the attention and therefore the affective and other responses of the listener. So I'm concluding that in many improvisation styles, it will turn out that the ramp archetype of dynamics is used. Obviously, I've only given you four examples, but I'm expecting that this will be fairly generalizable. I've noted that it applies to single pieces as well as to whole sets, and I've given you a rationale from a cognitive psychological point of view of why this might work and why it might be an essential component of using dynamics for signifying in the Rob Walser sense and the Gates sense, or signification in the broader cultural studies sense. And I'm interested in looking at the ramp archetype in a variety of other contexts, other kinds of jazz, but also other musical components of jazz like rhythm. And I think, for example, that the emphasis on the swing ratio, which Jeffrey Collier and a few other people, particularly the Honing group in the Holland have studied, will turn out to include an component of the ramp archetype. As you might know, Tony Williams is the drummer who has the highest swing ratio that's been observed in literature. Sometimes the long and short notes of a swing pattern are in a ratio up to 5-1. Elvin Jones sometimes gets up there too. And my theory is that probably they ramp that ratio during pieces, and that has yet to be investigated. And I believe that will be similar important ramps from the affective point of view to be investigated. I should say that we don't just do this work in isolation looking at structure. We also do affective studies in parallel, which I'm not talking about today, and there are close relationships. So what I'm saying is that a work constructed this way may well be more effective as a means of affective and other meaning transmission, and that there are ways that that can be tested beyond what I've showed you today.